Record, this is the Human Resources meeting. Today's date is March 24th, 2010. The time is about 3:32 in the afternoon. With us today are Senators Stevens, Wagner, French, Co-Chair McGuire, and myself, Borkowski. I should also note we're having some sound problems in the back of the room. I'm trying to get those fixed. Also note that we have Representative Millet in the audience with us. Today we have three bills before the committee that we'll take up in the following order. First up is Senate Bill 294 regarding sport fish guide licenses by Co-Chair McGuire. SB 143, the long-awaited Gretzky bill, will be next. And then last will be Senate Bill 275 regarding aquatic farming. And it's the policy of the committee to typically hold bills on their first hearing, so we give the opportunity for the public to weigh in and for committee members to offer amendments. So with that, first up is Senate Bill 294, Sport Fish Guide Licenses, and Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Senate Bill 294 would repeal the termination date for the program that we created to have a licensing of sport fish operators and sport fishing guides. And many of the people here in this room participated in the original bill, which was passed in 2004. Since then, the program has proven beneficial to both the industry and resource managers. It's estimated that over 1.8 million clients were served. 88% of them were non-residents, and taking more than 460,000 guided fishing trips in Alaska annually. It's a part of an integral part of Alaska's economy. And as other members know on this committee, we've tried to estimate the value of sport fish, the industry, to the state through a variety of mechanisms. But at least in this particular category, non-resident spending on sport fish was over $650 million estimated in 2007. So an important program, an average of 1,670 sport fishing licenses have been issued, and 1,981 sport fishing guide licenses. And the guide licenses include training, regular training, and safety briefings that the guides that I've talked to have reported as being a real important part of keeping a standard in the industry. So in 2009, we extended the termination date for one full year, and now we're proposing the permanent repeal, the permanent termination for that, the repeal of the termination, so that it would be a permanent part of Alaska law. And I think just a real responsible example of how you can get people out into Alaska to sport fish, but doing it with knowledgeable guides and some way to manage the resource, which we're responsible for ultimately.
All right, thank you. Questions for the bill sponsor? Did you want Mr. Pulaski to walk us through the six-line bill?
Yeah, it's a doozy.
Mike, if you could just put yourself on the record and anything else you want to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pulaski, and I'm an aide to Senator McGuire. In members' packet should also be the original language from House Bill 452 in your packet, just in case there's questions about the law that's being extended.
I just question. I wasn't involved in this before when it went through. You know, with a fisherman, Alaskans pay a different license fee for commercial fishing than out-of-staters do. Do we have any differentiation here between out-of-state guides and in-state guides?
We do, but I don't know if you know the answer through the chair, but I know Jen Uhas might know. She does know. There is a difference. Do you want to?
Yeah, and we have Jen Uhas and Kelly Swanton here from the administration. And do you want to come forward at this point? Just put yourself on the record. Welcome to the committee, Jen.
But no litigation on this one. No Carlson.
You never know.
Nope. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Jennifer Uhas, and I am the legislative liaison for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I have with me our sport fish director, Charlie Swanton. And there was a question asked, so I'll let Charlie answer that first before we give our testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Charlie Swanton. I'm the director of Sport Fish. Madam Chair, Senator Stevens, there is no differentiation between resident and non-resident guide and guides with regards to a fee. There's a $100 fee for a guide, business, operator, owner, and then for a guide, it's a $50 fee, and that is irrespective of whether they're resident or non-resident, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
So no difference, though. There is a difference in your actual license when you go to apply, but no difference in your guiding license.
Great. Other questions for the administration? All right, let me ask you, I assume you support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This legislation was introduced at the request of the department, and it genuinely has been a pleasure to work with the Senate on this issue over the last 2 years. This is the second time the Senate has introduced this legislation and given it a speedy hearing. This is identical to what was introduced last year by Senator Meyer. It passed this committee and the full Senate. It was later amended in the House to have the one-year sunset, and the Senate actually accommodated the concurrence vote as their last vote on the floor before we adjourned last year, and the department is very grateful for that. This logbook program provides for data collection that's necessary for information needed for state fisheries management. We've recently streamlined the process, and Mr. Swanton has some examples of our new scannable sheets. We no longer have the large, cumbersome, hand-filled out logbooks that have to be data entered for our saltwater guides. And this program exempts us from something called the National Saltwater Angler Registry, is being implemented in the rest of the United States. And some of the guides have testified that they would rather fall under that because it's a $25 fee rather than a $100 fee. But what that program does not provide us is the data in order to manage our fisheries. And it's generally been accepted that data is the most important part of this logbook program. What the guides receive for their $100 fee is not simply a sticker for their boat, but it's an ability to utilize this resource to earn an income. And Mr. Swanton can speak to the zero fiscal note, which in fact shows a shared burden of anglers and guides for this resource. Not all anglers use a guide, and we do believe that the guides benefit financially from the use of a natural resource held in the public trust, so they should share some of this burden. The fiscal note is made up, zero general funds. Everything is made up from program receipts from anglers and through the guide fee.
Other questions? And let me just welcome Senator Huggins. Mm-hmm. Senator French, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm just curious what the resistance was in the other body to extending the sunset for more than a year. What caused them to only extend this idea for a year?
Through the co-chair, Senator French, I am unable to speak to the logic that Representative Newman implemented in requesting that. I would direct that question to him.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Seeing none, let's move on to public testimony. Do we have anyone on the offense? Looks like we have. Looks like we have a few people scattered throughout the state. Let's start out with Mike McCrary from Anchorage. Could you put yourself on the record? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike McCrary. I'm in Anchorage, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. In review, I've been kind of got some history and background in the following the Sport Fish Task Force for guides that went on for a couple of years trying to establish their own sort of guide licensing board for guides. And the history on this particular sort of on this bill was to identify three problems. They needed more. We needed more information on the numbers of guides and the activities. We needed to provide comprehensive and credible data. And I believe the bill fairly certainly accomplished those goals. but it failed to establish anything more than minimum standards to actually be a guide. And from my point of view, outfitting, charter boats, air taxis, water taxis are businesses, and guiding is an occupation. And Alaska is a world-class destination for all sorts of guiding activities. And I believe that this legislation should not be put into place forever, so to speak, because I think the guiding component, the actual occupational licensing of all classes of guides, needs to be separated from the intent to reduce speculative entry of businesses into the commerce stream, and to enhance the profession of guiding, regardless of the class of guiding, and do that under one occupational licensing board for guides, like we have for hairdressers and barbers, for instance. So I just wanted to put that subject sort of on the table. I think that this bill tries to do too many things, and extending it is probably premature.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. McCrary. And just so all the testifiers know, we have a pretty full agenda. We have a number of people signed up to testify, so I'm going to limit testimony to 3 minutes. You were under 3 minutes. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up from the Matsu LAO, we have Melvin Grove.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. my name is Melvin Grove. I'm a charter. I own a charter business out of Valdez. I'm also on the Matanuska Fish and Game Advisory Council, board member of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Anyway, I guess I'd like to just start off with, the philosopher Edmund Burke once said the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And I guess I'm at fault there myself for in 2004 not fighting against this bill. I hope that you have all seen some of the correspondence, have read the correspondence I've had with Charlie Swanson over this issue. And my biggest concern is that, we are being taxed, basically is what this is, to pay for the logbook program. And I have nothing against collecting data and providing that data to the state. We understand that the data collection is important. But my problem is that when they instituted this, we're not seeing any improvements as a result of the data collection that we've been harvesting. We've seen loss in our bag limits, a loss in the resources, the department failing to really support citizens of the state to subsist even off of our fishing game. So that's part of the biggest beef that I think that the public has against continuing to fund a department that fails to give us anything really in return. So numerous issues, and I'd like to also correct Ms. Uas's statement that we would have to pay a $25 fee instead of the $100 fee. Actually, according to Forbes Darby, for us to register with the National Registry, it would be free. And also, anyone using our service in the saltwater federal waters would not have to register, because we would be collecting that data for them. I understand that the state requires any citizen fishes in Alaska to buy a fishing license. But the statement even that Mr. Swanton had made in his email that said that exemption would exempt them from paying the $15 to $25, if we didn't have that exemption, we'd be tacking that on to the citizens, is not true, because the federal system would be free to us guides, and it would be free to those folks using our service. So only those who were fishing without a guide service or on a charter or party boat would have to pay the registry. But the whole thing is why would not the, why wouldn't the state want to share this data anyhow with the feds? It is important data. There's no reason why we shouldn't share this data, but let's not use that as a justification to force us as guides to continue to pay $100. If they need additional funds, you know, add an extra dollar to the fishing license. I'm required to buy a fishing license, and yet I'm not even allowed to keep fish while I'm fishing with clients on my boat anymore. I mean, and that's just part of the frustration and disenfranchisement, if you will, that we as the public are pretty much just tired of. So if you're going to pass this, please keep a sunset in it. And I've made some suggestions as to maybe how the department can.
Can I get you to wrap it up, Mr. Grove?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear a buzzer. But anyway, yeah, I'm done. I'm through. So you can.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up is Ken Larson from Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ken Larson. I live here in North Pole, and I'm here representing the 28-member Prince William Sound Charter Boat Association as their secretary. We're probably flogging a dead horse here, but our members still wanted to go on record as opposing not allowing this to sunset, just as we did last year because of the funding issue. Mel has already covered the issue on using the national registry, so I'm not going to go into that. But we testified last year to at least get the funding straightened out on it. We do not object to the data collection, don't get us wrong, but between the license fees, sport license fees that both in-state and out-of-state residents pay, as well as guide fees that we pay, we're not getting much for our money. ADFG needs to look at other funding sources anyway. They've already said, and in one of the previous last week testimonies, they put up their budget where approximately the guide fees only pay for 55% of their $437,000 annual budget. Our clients, as I say, have already bought the sport license fee, so why, you know, those apply towards it, so why aren't more of those funds going towards it? I see no federal funding support from NOAA for the logbook data that they receive and are using. Excuse me?
Please go ahead. You have about 2 minutes left.
Okay. Sport fish license fee funding has reduced, if you haven't noticed, and I'm sure you have, as a result of the economy and other influences. The Southeast, for instance, they're going to lose 110 or 120,000 cruise ship passengers next year. And because of the one fish limit on halibut, you know, it's down. The revenues from license sales, license and king salmon stamps were down 12% in 2009 and 5% in 2008, and it's probably going to go down in 2010. In 2011, as I hope you're aware, the limited entry program for halibut charters is going to eliminate 38% of the halibut charter fleet here in Alaska, which will also cut Alaska Department of Fish and Game revenues. Scanning logbook data, as Charlie was saying a while ago, is a good idea. As we found out, there have been many data entry errors during our ongoing limited entry program process. Those cost reductions should mean position reductions in ADF&G, if nothing else. So you should have some more cost savings there. NOAA's restricted access management RAM system that we're undergoing for our charter halibut LEP program will eventually start charging us for it, just like they did on the commercial fisheries, where they pay a percentage of their gross fishery income. At any rate, the funding needs to be looked at. That's why we asked for the sunset to occur last year. That's why we're asking for the sunset to occur again this year, and try to do what you promised to do last year. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have also in Fairbanks, Reed Morisky.
Yes, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, and committee members. This is Reed Morisky in Fairbanks. I have Wilderness Fishing Incorporated. This will be my 26th summer up here operating in Fairbanks, and I would like to say that I'm in support of this act for repealing the termination date of licensing the sport fishing operators and sport fishing guides. The reasons are that this would require minimum insurance for businesses that operate as charters and guides. It requires CPR. The Coast Guard license does also, but that's every 5 years, and this confirms the CPR every year. The logbook information, I believe, is needed for documenting consistent use and access to the resource. Also, this act would ensure that ensure our clients that minimum standards are met, and improvements have been made to the logbook program that allow the guide supplied information to be scanned. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Next up, we have, staying in Fairbanks, Smokey Don Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman, representatives. My name is Smokey Don Duncan, Master Guide number 136. I do not support continuing the sport fish guide licensing program as written. I'd like to see the following amendments or see the program sunsetted. I believe the program should have a license fee exemption for fish guide businesses and sport fish guides who do not operate from a city, a town, village, or permanent lodge. I'd like to see an exemption for camp-based or float trip-based guides, and I'd like to see an exemption from multiple daily logbook recordings in the logbook for those camp-based and float trip-based guides. It should be changed, the regulations should be changed to you must fill in the logbook within 24 hours. I'd like to see Fish and Game be required to provide a waterproof container for this logbook or whatever they want me to fill out if I request it. I'd like to see the program drop entirely the U.S. Coast Guard requirement. They're totally absent from the Alaska Range North. Let them do their job. Don't try to do their job for them. Take that Coast Guard requirement out. They have no enforcement here north of the Alaska Range. Nowhere north of the Alaska Range do they have any ace of navigation or any experience. This program has done nothing but cost me time, money, and headaches. I recruit all of my clients with no help from the state. I pay land use fees, client day fees, and my clients and I buy fishing licenses. The state does virtually nothing to help promote or support the hunting and sport fishing guide industries. We spend millions for cruise ship docks and have a hard time collecting $50 a head from them. In fact, the state profits enough from air clients' license fees and air data reporting to justify suspending all guide license fees and business license fees. We already pay for a business license. Then we have to pay for a fish guide license. What's the deal with two licenses? This program needs to be reworked to consider the small guide out there and these areas. We, you know, not all the guides out there are taking two charter trips a day with six people on the boat getting $200 a head. Some of us are just taking a few people at once. And so I'm kind of against letting this thing go on forever. I think there's still things in it that need fixing. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Okay, moving to the off-nets, we have John Blair. Please put yourself on the record. Mr. Blair, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Blair, Executive Director for the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, located in Sitka. We represent sport fishing guides and lodge owners and our angler clients throughout the region. Today, I'd like to speak in support of this bill for three reasons. First, this is a clear-cut example of a program that actually does something right. Since its inception, the logbook program has successfully provided accurate and timely information for use by our decision makers at the Board of Fisheries and ADF&G, so the program works. Second, the logbook program has become the only effective means collecting data on the sport fishing industry in an objective and unbiased manner. Having independent and non-industry-based collection and enforcement ensures credibility of the information so that information is dependable. And third, these data are essential to ensure the conservation and sustainability of our fisheries. Without the logbook program, we would lose the quality data and science that have become the foundation of sound fisheries management. We Alaskans pride ourselves with our fisheries management based on facts and science. Well, this program is where the facts are created. Without it, we'd be in dire straits. So I encourage you to vote in favor of this legislation. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next up, we have a question from Senator Wagner.
How many members is in your association here in Southeastern?
We represent sent over 100 vessels and lodge owners throughout the region.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next up, we have on the off nets, Wade Willis.
Thank you, Chair and Co-Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to address this bill. My name is Wade Willis. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I had a guiding business for 10 years in Alaska from 1998 to about 2008. So I have a lot of experience in the guiding industry and in the tourism industry. I'm concerned, really, more than anything, in the long-term sustainability of our fishery stock in Alaska. And I tend to agree with the first testifier that the state needs to look further down the road and develop an occupational licensing board that licenses all guides in Alaska. We need to start getting the hiking guides, the photography guides, the fishing guides, the hunting guides, all under an occupational licensing board that ensures the quality of our guiding industry in Alaska is as good as it can be, and that the guiding industry is operating in a fashion that maintains the long-term integrity of our resources. I don't believe the current program has in place what we need to effectively manage the sport fish guiding industry. So I'm hoping that you would extend the sunset for two more years for one reason, to have one legislative session where an occupational licensing board can be discussed and considered, and we can possibly bring more professionalism into all guiding in the state. These special interest boards, like the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and now we're looking at trying to make a sport fish guiding board where a specific industry tries to manage itself, is fraught with problems. I mean, we can just look at the problems we're facing with the guided hunting industry right now. So we really need to turn the tide on that logic, in my opinion, and look to the long-term future of our guiding industry in Alaska, and try to develop a all-inclusive occupational licensing board. So my hope is that you will let this go for two more years so we have one more legislative session to develop something in that range. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Wade. Next up, we have Ricky Geese.
Hi, this is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. I'll just make my comments brief here. I would agree with comments by John Blair that the information collected from the department is crucial in fisheries management systems for the Board of Fisheries and the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I found the data to be incredibly useful. In fact, at the last Board of Fisheries meeting, data used in the guide logbook program is now going to allow guides in 3A to retain halibut in the upcoming year. The department's using that data for fisheries management, and it's incredibly useful data for those of us concerned about fisheries conservation in the state. I would concur with the need for an occupational, this kind of being not necessarily a stopgap measure, but setting minimum standards is important, but I would think that an occupational licensing board for fish guides is the evolution next step that you can consider in future sessions. And I'll keep it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ricky. Next up, we have Ruben Hanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ruben Hanke. I own and operate a small fishing business on the Kenai River. I am also a registered guide in the hunting industry, and I've heard some mention of some other people being that. I'd just like to point out that in the hunting industry, we pay a licensing fee through occupational licensing, and we do have to have a hunting license with us when we are in the field, so it's not unheard of. I'd just like to point out that, you know, we've talked about this data collection over and over, and there were some problems with it when this first came out, but I believe the department is working real hard to get those problems ironed out, and I think that now that the log books are going to be scannable, this information is going to be readily available, and at some point here in the not-too-distant future may be able to be used for in-season management decisions that need to be made in several fisheries across the state. So that's a big plus. I'd also like to mention that I operate a boat that's an open skiff, basically, on the Kenai River. It goes in the water in May. It comes out in the water in October. I don't have any problem keeping my logbook dry. I can certainly fill it out in the rain. It's no different than signing a king on the back of your license. We've been doing that for years, so that's not a problem. So, once again, I'd just like to reiterate that the data collection is of utmost importance to the fishing industry, and minimum standards in the guide industry right now is a big thing. And if we let this sunset, we lose those very minimum standards that we have currently in the fishing industry. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Ruben. And last up, we have Dave Gogia. Gogia?
Pretty close, Gogia.
Gogia.
I appreciate your time.
I should be better with names.
You own the small guide service on the Kenai River, run an open skiff, and we just try to keep our logbook as dry as possible, and it seems to work for us here. I think you've also heard some of the stuff I'm going to talk about. Just coming off the Board of Fish up in Anchorage, we heard a lot of times how the board members want accurate data. And to me, that's important to make any kind of decision that affects you and I and our industry here on the Kenai River and throughout the state. So we are in support of the logbook data. I'm also the Kenai River Professional Guide Association president, and so we support this as well. And thank you for your time.
Dave, thank you for your testimony. Sorry I got your name wrong. That's it for those that we have signed up. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Okay, administration, care to respond to any of the testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With response to the sunset and future programs, the department's very happy with the way this was introduced, and we're happy with the current version before you. And we'd just like to hold that should the legislature decide to audit or repeal this program at any point in the future, you're able to do that with or without a sunset. If you decide to introduce legislation for guide services boards or anything else, you don't need a sunset attached to that in order to do that.
Swan.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to just summarize the request from the public that we had last year with regards to the modernization of the program and the data accuracy. Ms. Juhas kind of made mention that the saltwater logbook program started out, the logbooks last year were 11.5 inches by 17 inches. They are now in your packet. You will see you have a scannable logbook sheet, which is now a standard 8.5 by 11 inches, and it is scannable. And we are going to be reducing the availability of that data from 8 to 9 months down to 1 to 2 weeks. So you heard some reference with regards to this information possibly in the not too distant future being used for in-season management purposes. Those were some of the major criticisms that we'd had in the past. And what we did was we went out and we took public comment, and we had the folks that are actually filling these things out make suggestions to us. And through that process, we improved this. We are planning on doing the same thing with the freshwater logbook program starting this fall and making that program scannable starting in essentially be in calendar year 11. So we've made the improvements that the public has asked us to do. And I might add that with regards to the quality of this data, we've had it reviewed by national experts, and they find that our data collection programs, and this was mentioned at the Board of Fisheries here last weekend, that we set the standard with regards to the quality and the accuracy and statistical precision of these data collection programs. That doesn't necessarily mean they can't be improved, and that's something that we're trying to do, but we've got it, and everybody else is following suit, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Swan. Okay, questions for the administration? Okay, with that, we're going to close public testimony. Okay, any final committee questions? Okay, the intention is to hold the bill over. If members have amendments, if they could please get them to us by tomorrow at noon, that'd be great. Okay, with that, we'll set the bill aside. Thank you. Next up, we have Senate Bill 143, Gretzky. We heard an overview last week on this bill. We did not have a CS at that time. We do have the CS, and it's /S, and at this time I would like to get a motion just to adopt it for discussion purposes only. Can I get a motion to do that? Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Objection to that? Okay. CS is adopted just for discussion purposes only. Mr. Strandberg, welcome to the committee again. And could you please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. We are pleased again to be before you for Senate Bill 143, commonly known as GRETC. I'm Jim Strandberg, project manager with the Alaska Energy Authority, and I have with me today Mr. Brian Bjorkqvist, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. We were with you last week and provided an overview of the GRETC committee substitute that was created this year in a collaboration with the Governor's Office, Alaska Energy Authority, and the Rail Belt Utility Boards of Directors. At that time, we did not have the actual committee substitute with us. We are now back with the committee substitute in hand.
Just for the record, just procedurally, I asked for a motion to the CS. I'm going to object just so that we can discuss the CS, and then if we do decide as a committee we want to remove that objection, then I'll do so. But please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Today, in the half hour available, I really propose to explain to you the committee substitute, and I did bring the PowerPoint slide back with me. There are just a couple of takeaways which I want to take a few minutes to share with you again. And then really I'd like to have Mr. Bjorkqvist explain to you the bill section by section, but at a high level. And I promise you that he's going to make it very interesting so that it's not difficult to go through this. And we'll stay within the half hour limit. There are some key points of the GRETC bill that we wanted to bring back to you. First of all, the basis of the bill, the business structure study, was the REGA study, if you'll recall. And we also have a state-sponsored integrated rail belt integrated resource plan. Those are two key documents which are the basis and foundation which are foundation elements of the creation of the statute. And remembering that we work collaboratively with the utilities, and indeed the accomplishment of the REGA study was done in concert with the utilities. What keeps coming back is, I'm not characterizing it as a call to arms, but it really expresses one of the reasons why we are here. And it is the capital shortfall diagram, which demonstrates the actual or the realistic expectation of how much money the utilities can raise to build new infrastructure versus the expectation of the needs of capital out of the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan. And it demonstrates a capital gap. So in many ways, one could ask the question, why would we not just turn the utilities loose to solve this themselves under existing statutes? And one logical conclusion is that if there is this capital gap and the state may in some way need to be involved financially, it would make sense that the vehicle that we construct for that should be done in a partnership fashion between the state and the utilities, so we have a vehicle that can handle the money.
Let me note that Senator Menard has joined us. Welcome, Senator. And Senator French has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe you answered it when you inserted the aspect of state involvement, because One part of this Gretzky legislation I'm not quite getting is how you get a stronger. If you take six small utilities, put them into one big utility, how do they get any stronger financially than they were before? They're still six small utilities. Their assets don't go up. Their balance sheet doesn't get any better. They're just you just put them all into one building, and now you've got six little utilities. If you add state money, I can see that's different, and maybe that's the answer to my question.
Through the chair, Senator French, good question. The REGA study projected that if the utilities act jointly over the long run to unify the network, there are cash savings to rail belt ratepayers through more efficient use of infrastructure. And by creating a larger organization, they create more financial power, and they're likely going to be able to get financing on better terms. So that would lower the costs of debt. In the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, the Appendix B, there is a financial analysis done by Seattle Northwest, which discusses that very point about what are the ways that a Gretzky-like organization could actually capitalize the future and save money. Well, I hope that answered your question.
I'll look at the appendix, and maybe that'll help me understand, you know, just, I mean, what's, is there a multiplier effect? I mean, what's at work there? And or maybe more fundamentally, how much utility money do you see involved here, you know, given the combined, you know, whatever it is they gain out of joining one another, and how much state money do you see being necessary to get our utilities in shape for the future?
Through the co-chair. Another good question. The company really is designed to capitalize itself through equity and injections. And basically, when you build a company, you need to have a certain amount of skin in the game, i.e. the equity. And if you have equity and solvency, you're able to borrow money. And basically, the task in forming the company will be to, first of all, get the right bylaws, get the right board, and to create equity so that the company can go out and borrow money. Now, exactly how that equity is formed is an open question. That there's many different ways to do that. One of them, of course, would be for the state to come up with some funds. There may be other ways as well, but this legislation really creates the framework through which those processes can begin to occur. And I'd comment that when utilities sell bonds, they are the company operations are carefully scrutinized by financial institutions that basically rate these bonds and rate the risk, and the lower the risk, the lower the interest rate. So if we create this company in a partnership with some significant backing, it's likely that it's going to be able to achieve efficient and inexpensive financing.
Thank you.
So I wanted to just explain why we are here. The other question that has been prevalent or that I've been hearing is, why don't we just let the utilities create a joint action agency, which is an existing business structure that the utilities certainly could afford themselves if they wanted to go do things on the rail belt. And I think the best way to approach this is that if we have a fully functional generation and transmission entity in a mature network, there are really four tasks that that entity should do. One of them would be to manage the transmission system. The second one would be to evolve towards regional economic dispatch so that the generators are used most efficiently. The third one is regional planning, long-range regional planning for major projects. And then the fourth is joint project development. And in many ways, the JAA legislation is really focused on the fourth element, which is joint project development. Now, the JAA language, a portion of it is relatively open architecture, so there certainly are ways for the utilities to use that and to move forward to do things together. But the Gretzky is really designed to embrace those four elements of the future network in an ordered fashion, in a manner that the utilities are comfortable with, and that it really does represent a first step in the evolution of the network. And indeed, it's a more complete solution, if I could, I think is a clear way to say it. So those are two elements of the legislation that in our discussions we've discussed with various staff people and with senators. And given the time constraints, I don't want to go much further. I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Bjorkqvist to give a very fulfilling and energetic discussion of the bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brian Bjorkqvist. I am a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. I have represented the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for about 13 years. In that representation, I have been involved with the acquisition of the Snettisham hydroelectric dam and the financing of that. I've been involved with the divestiture of the four dam pool and by the Alaska Energy Authority and the financing of that by ADA. I've been involved with AEA's energy projects, the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project and the Alaska Intertie. So I have an involvement or have had experience and involvement in financing for large projects and also some of the operational aspects to it. Just as a matter of my background. The corporation that you see in the work draft is basically modeled after a generation and transmission cooperative. That's a type of entity where utilities get together to jointly provide for their generation and transmission needs. They plan for it, they develop it, they are able to use it. The utilities in a G&T type format still are the distribution element of the utility. So the utilities would take power, wholesale power, from the generation transmission cooperative and then sell it to their retail customers, the distribution part of the utility business. That's basically what this corporate format is modeled after. The original bill created one specific corporation. This bill has been changed to provide a general law creation of a form of energy and transmission corporation, and within it limitations on who can form. It has to be four or more municipal or cooperative utilities, and there has to be approval by law for the formation. And then in the bill, there's the actual authorization for the formation. This model is similar to the model that was used in the Joint Action Agency statute, where the formation of a Joint Action Agency under 42, 45, 310 required legislative approval for the acquisition of a project from the Alaska Energy Authority. So it's modeled after the same type of formation, with legislative approval being a component part of it. There's a subtle shift in this legislation from the original bill. The original bill was just a little bit more of a quasi-public corporation, with the corporation anticipated at that time taking on more of a little bit more of a public function for the Rail Belt region in particular. This bill provides just a little bit more freedom or flexibility for the utilities. They're not required at any point, there's no expectation that they have to obtain all of their power from this organization. There was an implication in the last bill that there would. So there's a subtle shift, so it's a little bit more of a private corporation, a little bit less of a quasi-public corporation, but it still has elements of being a quasi-public entity, and this entity will be performing public services for the region that it serves. This draft also reflects a combination of long work with the task force, the utilities, and in the last several days, back and forth, primarily between the Department of Law and Legislative Legal on drafts and memos and questions about what's trying to be done with this, and attempts to clean up the language and make it accomplish what was originally intended. I'll now just basically go through parts of the bill and point out some of the highlights, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have throughout. I believe that, just back to legislative legal, I think that this draft reflects a response to every question that was raised, with one exception, and that's one where I could talk about what the issue is, but I think the answer is to just follow legislative legal's advice and clarify that there's no issue with some of the provisions dealing with rate exemption from rate regulation and how they can apply. So rather than put you through a circular thought process, I'll just move on, and there's just one issue that would still need to be addressed. Sections 1, 4, and 5 of the bill deal with exemptions from rate regulation. Under the bill, these three sections will become effective in 2015. There will be 5 years of regulation under the RCA, and then afterwards rate regulation takes place. The rate regulation provisions exempt this corporation from regulation by municipalities and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. There are provisions in the municipal code and RCA statutes that basically provide that if an entity is exempt from regulation by RCA, a municipality, city or borough, can regulate. This exempts from municipal regulation and RCA regulation in combination.
Mr. Chair, and maybe you can just explain to us why that's a good idea. Why create a new power company that is exempt from the RCA?
There are arguments that are going to be made in favor of that. I know because I've listened to the task force, and you're going to hear from the utilities a number of things. You're going to hear from the utilities that there's a cost-benefit analysis, that the cost of regulation outweighs the benefits from it. You're going to hear from the utilities that a G&T cooperative type model elsewhere is not subject to rate regulation, and for a variety of reasons, you're going to hear from them why that might be appropriate. And I can't get into any more detail. I can forewarn you that you're going to hear from the utilities on that topic. That's about the best I can do right now.
So we're just flagging the issue for later.
Yes.
Okay, it's flagged. Fair enough. Thank you.
Yeah, well, so let me ask you the practical impact of giving them 5 years of this exemption. Would that apply to projects that were built during that 5 years, projects that were permitted during that 5 years? How exactly would that work?
During the first 5 years, it would apply to any business that the corporation would be involved with, whether it was an involvement with an existing asset that they acquire or a new asset that was built during that five-year period of time. Now, the contemplation in the formation of the corporation is that there may not be many assets put into this corporation early on. The utilities, again, have the flexibility to retain the current assets, and so during that period of rate regulation, there may or may not be aspects of the assets within the corporation that would be part of it. But there's also contemplations in the bill that the Gretzky Corporation may not need to acquire title to assets to be able to get some sort of operational control over it. If they operate a project, then they would be able to achieve some of the benefits that Mr. Strandberg talked about with organizing in a larger basis without actually taking title ownership. But for the first 5 years, it's going to be subject to rate regulation no matter what. After 5 years, the regulation would it be exempt from regulation from basically any power that it sold. So if it was selling power based on owning an asset or having an agreement that would allow it to operate and sell power from the project, it would be exempt from regulation to that extent.
So if Chugach Electric owned a generation plant under Chugach Electric's name, they go out, they want to go to the RCA, get a rate approved, they still have to go through the RCA process. But if they put the assets into Gretzky, then for 5 years they're exempt. Is that basically the way it works?
For the first 5 years, they are subject to rate regulation. So for the first 5 years, no matter what,
the asset would be subject to rate regulation. The corporation, Gretzky, will be subject to rate regulation.
And then after 5 years, I guess I misinterpreted you. After 5 years, then no regulation.
That's correct.
So if Gretzky decided that they wanted, in 6 years from the time we passed the bill, they wanted to go out and build Susitna Hydro or contract for Susitna Hydro to provide electricity for the entire rail belt, then they wouldn't have to go for RCA rates. They wouldn't have to go before the RCA.
That is correct.
But if they do it in year five, they do have to go to the RCA.
At least for that 1 year of operation.
Wow. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple questions along the same lines, just to make sure that I understand the term rate regulation means go before the RCA to get approval of your rate. Is that what it means?
That's my understanding of the term.
Okay. You're the attorney working in this area. I mean,
yes.
Okay. Is Gretzky going to sell power to individual customers, or do you see Gretzky selling power through Chugach, MLMP, Golden Valley, et cetera?
The contemplation, as I have heard from the task force, is most of the power will be sold at wholesale to individual utilities. There is a power within the corporation that it can sell power to industrial customers with some limitations. It cannot sell power to an industrial customer in a service territory of another public utility unless that public utility consents, and that's under 4250-09024, I believe, is the new number with the CS.
And just a follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Just under this new draft, if, say, Homer Electric decides to participate in Gretzky, they can donate or they can participate as much as they like or as little as they like. There's no. It's not as if you step under the Gretzky umbrella and you're now Gretzky. You decide what portion of your association's assets you want to turn over to Gretzky or none, and join the association or join the umbrella organization. Is that right?
Not exactly. There are two different components.
Price of admission. What do you have to pay to get into Gretzky?
Nothing has to be paid to become a member. Under the legislation, those that provide a letter of intent, a sufficient letter of intent to AEA by the deadline, become a member. There is no price for becoming a member. Now, there's no obligation on being a member to acquire any level of services or power or anything else. Becoming a member doesn't trigger anything. Getting to the point of what assets would be in and what would be out, it's not just a matter of what the utility would desire, but also a negotiation with the corporation itself. And there may be a utility, for example, might want to provide not the best of assets, and Gretzky would want the best. And so there's a negotiation as to what would be accepted by the corporation and the willing utility would want to put in. It might be asset by asset or a package portfolio, but there needs to be a negotiation. It's not unilaterally available to either side to elect what can go in.
Thank you.
And just so members of the committee are aware, we do plan on having the utilities testify tomorrow. We just didn't have enough time today, but I'll just say to those utilities that are out there, from my perspective, they will have a very, very high burden of proof to prove, at least to me, why not being regulated after 5 years is a good thing. So I know that's not for you to comment on, but please proceed.
Okay. Section 2 of the bill, and this again will become effective in 2015, this provides a provision that a wholesale agreement for the sale of power from Gretzky to a utility is not subject to approval or review or approval by the RCA until all of the debt associated, long-term debt incurred for the project is retired. This is a provision that currently applies to the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project and two of the four Four Dam Pool Project, Swan Lake and Lake Tai. Those are the ones that are still in a joint action agency. And so this is a provision that basically allows the cost of the project to go to a utility and get passed through into their rates. And it also is not subject to rate regulation, the cost of that power as it goes to the utility. The RCA is basically accepts those costs.
The purpose of this is to assist in financing projects. In order to be able to finance projects, you have to have a reliable source of repayment, and this provision provides a reliability to the repayment of projects.
Can I just ask you a question? What section are you going to next?
I was on section 2. I'm going to jump ahead to section 6.
Let me just ask you a question on section 2. Looking at line 15, you talk about related contracts for wheeling storage. What kind of contracts would you have for storage? What are you contemplating there?
The language included in that is similar to the language that was included in the exemption for both Bradley Lake and for Four Dam Pool. There could be a storage of electricity. The only part of the system in the rail belt that I'm familiar with is Golden Valley has a BESS system. And my colleague says that it might be water storage in a dam. But these are provisions that were in other contracts, and therefore it's trying to extend the same type of contractual exemption.
Would that apply to gas storage?
It potentially could.
So you would be exempting them from gas storage regulation?
This would be an exemption from the contract, the wholesale contract between Gretzky and a public utility for that service.
Mr. Greenberg?
I'm just going to say that I don't believe that this was meant for gas or fuels. I believe that in the reading of it that it is a repurchase of power, and power is electricity.
I was...
Yes, Senator French.
Mr. Chair, I was going to either suggest or at least throw out for the consideration of the committee insertion of the word electric in front of power on line 16, just so it's clear. Or at least that's the way you read it right now, is that it has the word electric modifying power. It's just something to keep in mind.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Starting section 6, starting on page 3, this is the bulk of the statutory section for an energy and transmission corporation. Lines 16 through 19 speak of four or more electric utilities, if authorized by law, can form a corporation. If you look at the lines 20 through 25, that basically outlines the purposes or why the corporation is formed: to acquire, operate, or maintain projects from the Alaska Energy Authority, one, and second, for planning, coordinating, and addressing generation and transmission concerns of the region. The purposes, I'll just highlight a few of them. On page 3, line 30, one of the purposes is to be a primary recipient of state financial assistance for generation and transmission projects in the region. This is not a legal obligation, but it's a political it's a type of policy or political barrier. For a decade, the Rail Belt utilities have been told that they need to organize and coordinate with each other if they're going to get access to the Rail Belt Energy Fund. That's a purpose of this. It's a mechanism for them to organize and coordinate to get access to those funds.
I just want to stop you and ask you a question on lines 16 through 19 of page 3. It's on page 18 in specific. It says organize four or more municipal or cooperative public utilities may organize an energy and transmission corporation. So I guess under the strict language that you have here, you could act. It appears that you could have multiple corporations. Is that correct?
There's also the line on page, or line 18, the phrase "if first authorized by law,"
And so the possibility of that happening would be contingent upon the legislature allowing it to happen under this legislation as it's drafted.
Senator French.
So that does provoke a question. Does that mean that after they've organized, they've got to, I mean, is this not the authorization they need by law to do what they need to do, or is there something else?
The authorization that is required by law is in Section 13 of this bill. And the Section 13 authorizes the listed, four or more of the listed public utilities, which are the rail belt public utilities, to form generation and transmission corporation, the GRETSI corporation. Section 14 provides a conditional effect that will also cover that Section 13 under the proposed amendment to pick that up. The four or more utilities have to submit a letter of intent and form and substance acceptable to the Alaska Energy Authority in order to be able to form the corporation.
But there's no subsequent legislative action necessary in order for GRETSI to form itself.
Not with this bill.
Right. The bill is the authorization.
That is correct.
Right. Okay.
And why don't you. And is there a reason you just don't say on page 3, line 18, where it says, if first authorized by law, organize the Greater Rail Belt Energy and Transmission Corporation? Just so we're perfectly clear.
There are two reasons, and they're interrelated. As the legislative legal pointed out, asked a question whether there's a problem with this bill as local and special legislation. Having a statute of general application helps address that particular potential issue or problem, constitutional problem. And so that's one of the advantages of having an act of general law. And the other comment I would have is that the way that this bill has been changed by the task force is a little bit less of a quasi-public corporation, a little bit more of a private corporation. And so that's another justification for having a shift in emphasis. The original bill was modeled after CFAB, which is a quasi-public type organization. It's private in many ways, but serves a public function.
Great, thank you.
Then there are provisions starting on page 4, line 3, through 21 that focus on some of the details, more detail on the planning that this corporation would provide. And then there's some general provisions that are similar to the original bill as to what its powers and the intention, the purposes for the corporation were. I'll point out at the bottom of page 4, subsection G, lines 28 through line one of the next page, there is an emphasis on this corporation providing interconnection type services. There are other provisions in the bill that also talk about this corporation providing operating standards. That's important, particularly in the rail belt, because the current operating standards between utilities is partially voluntary, partially by contract. The Alaska Intertie Agreement includes within it reliability operating standards that are supposed to apply to the rail belt. Not all of the utilities in the rail belt are signatories to that, and so several of the utilities voluntarily follow those standards. That agreement is also scheduled to terminate this next October, and so a GRETSI formed under this legislation will fill a void that otherwise would be missing as to helping to put together reliability and interconnection standards. I'll also point out that in the bill there's a clarification or attempt at clarification that this organization would not be able to preclude independent power producers from getting access to the transmission system. There's express provision that RCA's jurisdiction over joint use and interconnection would continue as to this organization even after it is no longer subject to regulation. That's the one point that legislative legal suggested maybe there's a clarification that we can work on that, but that's the intent. That way, this organization can fulfill a public function without going overboard and excluding others from the system to participate.
Okay. Is that where, what section is that about cannot preclude IPPs?
It is in, Mr. Chairman, it is... Section 7, specifically on page, I apologize, it's section 8 on page 18. This would be an amendment to AS 4250-100 that will take effect in 2015, and the B2 is the language.
And how do you, okay, so let's say you have an IPP, let's say you have Fire Island, for instance, and they want to be a, they want to put their power into the system, and how do, how would the interconnection work at that point? What if they can't come up with an acceptable cost agreement?
There are two statutes under RCA regulation that are cited in that one section. One provides an obligation on utilities to negotiate for joint use and interconnection. The second statute says that if the utilities don't negotiate an adequate deal, that the RCA can step in and order joint use and interconnection and establish rules that would apply to that.
So this section 2, B2, lines 7 through 9 on page 18, if you could just briefly explain how that works, how that prevents preclusion of an IPP, because I think this is going to be a big issue down the line as we have all these smaller IPPs coming and wanting to put their power into the grid. I see this as potentially a big issue.
What this provision is, and it's 4205-311, that requires utilities to negotiate joint use and interconnection so that an independent power producer who wants to put their power onto the transmission system so they can sell it to their purchaser, first they have an obligation to negotiate to allow that to happen. And if they fail to negotiate a deal, the second statutory provision is where the RCA steps in and orders that to happen with the terms and conditions that would be applicable.
And would that be after a comprehensive hearing where the RCA hears from the IPP, the RCA would hear from GRETSI, other power providers, and decide, number one, whether they should be put in, and number two, what the rate would be? And how would that work?
I have only been involved with joint use and interconnection in one context, and that had to do with the Alaska Intertie. There is 19 miles of the original Alaska Intertie that was subject to contract between the Alaska Energy Authority and Matanuska Electric. Matanuska Electric terminated that, and in order to allow, not allow there to be a disruption of services, other utilities went to the RCA for an order for joint use and interconnection. There was negotiations for a period of time, followed by a hearing before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and an order ordering joint use and interconnection with the terms and conditions.
Okay, please proceed.
On page 5, the Board of Directors. The Board of Directors, there are each public utility member of GRETSI will have two representative member directors on the board, and then the governor will select one director from a list of directors submitted by the public utility members. Moving on to page 7, membership. There are two types of members. Page 7, line 17. There are two different types of members of an energy and transmission corporation. There's a public utility member, which, as I just mentioned, they have two representative directors. And then there are members who are other entities that purchase power or services from that, but they do not have representative directors. The qualifications for membership as a public utility member include it has to be a municipal or a cooperative, has to be electrically interconnected, and excludes affiliates of a public utility member so that you don't have duplicate voting rights.
And I'm assuming that the membership definition here is essentially includes the seven rail belt utilities. CEA, I mean, those would be the ones who would be eligible to be members. Or are there others?
Originally, the legislation under Section 16, or 13, excuse me, lists six rail belt utilities that are eligible to become a member. And that doesn't go through this process. If they satisfy the condition under Section 14, they will become an original public utility member. Others would have to satisfy those criteria and then be approved for membership by a two-thirds vote by the public utility or by the board of directors.
Okay, but I guess I'm looking at page 7, subsection B, line 23, and on. I'm assuming that your definition of a public utility member includes the six, is it six or seven? Six public utilities. And Chugach, MLMP,
yes, it does.
Et cetera, GVA.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, it's those six who qualify, at least right now.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Moving on to page 9, the starting line 25, general powers of the corporation. The general powers that are listed basically pick up most of the powers of electric cooperatives. I'll just highlight a couple of the provisions. Section A8, page 10, line 13, that's the provision that allows for sales to industrial customers with limitations on if there is a public utility with a service territory. Section A15, which is page 11, line 8. This is the power to exercise eminent domain. This is the power granted is the power that is granted to every public utility, but there's a limitation. GRETC cannot exercise eminent domain to take a generation or transmission asset from another public utility, and so it has lesser powers than a public utility has, and no more than what a public utility has. Then subsection B, 90B on page 12, 10 through 14, this is a limitation to protect the members that GRETC in providing a contract with members can't preclude them from having bilateral contracts with others for power sale or wheeling. Moving on again, page 12, line 21, and basically the next four sections. These provide for regional planning, and this is one of the areas where GRETC is to perform and may provide some significant advantages. The best opportunity to save money for ratepayers frequently is before money is spent constructing a project. At that point in time, you can choose between alternatives and pick the best choice between alternatives. Rate regulation generally doesn't address rate issues until after a project is built, and so you miss an opportunity to pick between alternatives. Having regional planning can be effective in a number of ways to help that process. First, the information is available to the corporation and members to help them make better decisions. Ratepayers will have the information. They can use that with their utilities if they're doing it or suggesting an imprudent expenditure. And probably more significantly, the legislature will have that information both in oversight over the corporation, and there's ongoing oversight with information to be provided, and also in dealing with state financial assistance. If there are choices being made in the regional planning that the legislature would question, that will come up when the state financial assistance is being discussed. And to highlight that, moving on to...
Senator Wagner has a question before you move on.
Yeah, I'd like to back up a little bit to eminent domain. Why would we have Gretzky be capable of exercising power of eminent domain when each of the membership organizations already have that power, and they are much more answerable to the constituents of ours and theirs that live in that district where eminent domain is going to be used than the board of Gretzky overall would be? I always have a little trouble when we get to eminent domain and the right of taking private property for a public purpose. And I don't feel too comfortable with that section in there. Is there some reason they had to have that?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, the purpose of this section is to give the entity that would be needing the property to perform or to be able to develop their project or to fulfill their purpose, the power to achieve that. If the corporation did not have that power, it would have less power than any other public utility, and wouldn't be able to, arguably wouldn't be able to develop a project unless some other entity would be willing to exercise its powers of eminent domain, which might create problems for that other entity, because eminent domain also requires paying for what is being taken. And so the having the entity that is developing the project and going to be responsible for the payment, having that power, there's just a synergy between them.
Please.
Well, I hate to argue the point with you, but when it comes to paying, they're not always paid what they can prove the value of the property being taken is. I mean, there's a lot of cases where that's been the case. And so I just think we're going a step too far here with this eminent domain. I just think we're setting up a board who will have the authority and the power. If Homer Electric, say, objects to a project in their area, or in some cases, if they don't object, they can hide behind this organization that we're preparing to enable and allow this organization to use eminent domain to take over property, and they can hold their hands up and say, "Well, it wasn't me. It was this organization that a lot of people don't understand, and they won't understand it because it's not something they deal with every day. It's not somebody they send their check for electricity use to." So I just have a real inherent distrust. The further you get away from your customer, the less trust I tend to have when it comes to eminent domain. I don't think that's necessary.
May I make?
Yeah, Ms. Tremmer.
Through the chair, co-chair, Senator Wagner, I share your concern about the heavy hand of government taking away land for public purposes. It's an area of controversy, and people have been hurt by it. I would comment that generation and transmission organizations, one of the most difficult parts of the company is going to be securing areas so it can actually build transmission lines.
I understand that.
And the Alaska Energy Authority has been working with MLMP on a transmission line, a new transmission line from Hatcher Pass down to Kinnick. And we face those issues. While the eminent domain power is there in practice, at least with this current band, we do not even look at going there. But It is very common, and I'll put this for your consideration, for G&T organizations throughout the United States to have some form of eminent domain power. And the hope is that we have the right board structure and the right governance so that the concerns from the retail customer flows up into the governance of the new company. And I'll offer that to you.
All right, thank you. It's a policy call on our part, and I'm sure we'll have a heated debate about it. Yeah. Please go ahead.
I was just mentioning the aspect of the legislature appropriating money, and I wanted to point out on page 14, starting on line 11 in the 4250-150 financing arrangements, there are a list of types of state financial assistance that the corporation may obtain. Two points I want to make on that. There is nothing in this bill that obligates the state to provide any financial assistance. That's one point. The second point is there is nothing in this bill that limits the strings that the legislature can impose with any financing, state financial assistance that's provided. This bill and the formation of GRETC, there is definitely a contemplation that there's going to be state financial assistance provided. There's also every expectation that there's going to be negotiation about terms and conditions that are going to be attached to that state financing conditions. A major point in this bill is it's just a starting point for a lot of the terms and conditions that might be imposed more specifically on a project-by-project basis. But that there's every expectation that there are going to be some concessions that are going to be required tied to any state financial assistance that would be provided to this corporation. Backtracking, and I know that's probably a problem at this point, but going back to page 12, lines 25 through 30, just wanted to make one point. In the integrated resource plan and the next section, the long-range fuel supply plan, the corporation is obligated to evaluate and consider state energy plans or other plans, and if they choose to deviate from those plans, they have to include a report explaining the differences and why they've deviated. This is important not because it creates a legal obligation, but it creates transparency and political accountability. And as I just mentioned, every expectation is this corporation is going to be coming to legislature for money. And if they're deviating from state energy plans, that's going to be an opportunity for the legislature to ask questions. As they provide annual reports and you're talking with them, this is an opportunity to get information that you can use and ask questions of what they're doing. And so I just wanted to highlight that. I know that I've well overrun the time that Mr. Strandberg allotted to me, and I am sure that I have failed to keep this as scintillating as he promised, which I was somewhat chagrined when he was offering me up in that fashion in the first place. There are other many, many other terms and conditions in this. Many of them are basically tied to corporate type functions. Some of them are unique to GRETC. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have now or later with any of the details. I could go through the rest of this, but I'm not sure that it would add much. I think I picked up the many of the highlights. And Mr. Chairman, if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to try to address them.
Well, really appreciate the scintillating testimony. And this is an important bill, and it is something which we've been waiting for a long time, and we had a large chunk scheduled today. We've heard this last week. We've heard this last year. We'll hear it again tomorrow. Committee members have other questions. There's a lot here to digest. I'm sure we'll all be going home and poring over it tonight. And we look forward to hearing back from you. We'll be back tomorrow as well?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Good.
Yes.
Great. Thank you. And any other questions by the committee members? Okay, seeing none. We do have, it's 5 o'clock now. I know everyone's tired. We've had a long day. Co-Chair McGuire and I have talked, and we're gonna put off SB 275 for today just because of the lateness of the hour. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thanks, guys.